Hello and welcome to Behind the News for February 28, 2009. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up this morning. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the economic journalist Jeff Madrick on the crisis, the budget, the rescue, and all that. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from David Himmelstein, who, besides being a primary care physician, is one of the founders and leading lights of Physicians for a National Health Program on what's in and what's out of the Obama health scheme. Before all that, some words in the economic news, which continues to be bad, quite bad. On Thursday, we learned that the number of new applications for unemployment insurance rose a sharp 36,000, and the number of people continuing to receive jobless benefits rose by 114,000, also a sharp rise. While neither figure is at record levels when taken as a percentage of the labor force, by those measures, things still aren't as bad as they were in the recessions of the mid-1970s and early 1980s, they've nonetheless been rising steeply and relentlessly. That rise, in year-to-year terms, is now very close to breaking the 1974 record, meaning the job market is still deteriorating and at what now looks like an accelerating rate. That bleak picture of the job market was underscored earlier in the week with the release of the Conference Board's monthly survey of consumer attitudes. Most of these mood surveys aren't very useful. They reflect the headlines more than they shape them. But unlike the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Survey, the Conference Board asks people about the state of the job market, and those responses are a good real-time measure of what's going on beneath the surface. And by that measure, the labor market is a wreck. Just over 4% of respondents say that jobs are plentiful, which is pretty close to an all-time low since the series starts in 1978. 48% say they're hard to get, which is close to an all-time high. And the housing figures released this week also remain dismal. Sales of existing houses in January fell 7% from a year earlier. Not a horrible number, nor was the actual level one for the record books. But close to half the sales were of distressed properties, meaning in foreclosure or close to it. That's dragging down prices, which were down almost 14% from a year earlier and 26% from their 2006 peak. At present rates, it would take over 9 months to move all the houses currently for sale, and about a quarter of that inventory is distressed. Sales of new houses in January were down 48% from a year earlier, and adjusted for population, the rate of sale is at record lows. It would take over 13 months to clear out the unsold inventory at present sales rates, also an all-time record. And prices were down over 13% over the year, not an all-time record, but close to it. And it's pretty likely the economy can't recover till housing turns around. The prevalence of records and near records in the last couple of paragraphs suggests that we're not really close to bottoming out yet. If we're approaching a bottom, you might expect the rate of decline to be slowing, grasping at second derivatives we are, but it's not. And the state of the job and housing markets are the most important aspects of that abstraction known as the economy to real people. Not that things are going all that well in the high abstract level of the financial markets either. About the only bit of encouraging news I can find is, as I reported here a couple of times before, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which forecasts changes in the economy 3 to 6 months out. It's declining at a progressively slower rate, which suggests that there may be some bottom in sight. Underscore suggests and may. But finally, a comforting second derivative. I gotta say, though, that the news in the financial bailout continues to be disappointing. The Obama administration is clearly going very easy on Wall Street. The much-typed stress tests for major banks aren't much of anything at all. As a Citigroup analysis put it on Thursday, the tests aren't onerous, and the overall plan looks very bank and investor-friendly. The administration is doing everything it can to avoid nationalizing these busted institutions, and even when they pump money in, as they did with Citigroup the other day, they do it with few obvious strings attached. We'll know we're really in a new era, economically and politically, when the administration's approach becomes a lot less indulgent. Justice requires that, but so does economic recovery. The outlines of the first draft of Obama's first budget, though, are more encouraging. To start with, It's an honest document, which brings the cost of war onto the budget instead of being covered with the phony emergency resolutions that Bush preferred. Raising taxes on the very rich is also a good move. It's good to see some serious action on greenhouse gas emissions, though I'd much prefer a carbon tax to a cap-and-trade system. Parenthetically, this is a rare instance where I come down on the side of economists on an issue. Economists argue that carbon taxes produce much more stable and predictable paths for energy prices over the long term, while cap-and-trade systems, which allow polluters to buy and sell their rights to foul the atmosphere, tend to produce a great deal of price volatility. Enviros usually prefer caps because they're direct and mandatory, but the price volatility that such systems can give rise to makes it very difficult to plan for the future. But this is a topic for many other shows. Back to the budget. The health care fund, 630-some billion over the next decade, is a nice gesture, but it's still not what we really need, which is a single-payer system. We'll hear more on this from David Himmelstein in about 25 minutes, but single-payer is the only way you can get universal coverage and cost control, because you get the parasitical insurance companies out of the picture. The deficit is going to be big, very big. It was strange to read in the World Socialist website these deficits are dangerous. Their analysis sounded eerily like those of deficit hawks like Pete Peterson and the Concord Coalition. Either we have big deficits or everything goes down the drain. Of course, if you want everything to go down the drain, then I guess you don't like big deficits. But after the emergency passes, assuming it does, that is, it's time to get serious about soaking the rich to bait on some of the debt incurred in this vast rescue operation. I've long maintained that borrowing money from the rich, which is what deficit spending fundamentally does, is a very poor substitute for taxing them. Big deficits are an essential strategy for getting out of a crisis, but they're not a good way to run an economy over the long term. Okay, putting all this together, the budget looks like bigger than baby steps in the right direction, the first serious signs at the fiscal level of a reversal of the priorities of the last 30 years. But it's only a beginning, and it has to get through Congress. Oh, and we talk a lot about trillions of dollars. I do it myself rather casually. It is, though, when you stop to think about it, an almost unthinkable number. Here's an approximation of $1 trillion. If you counted out a $100 bill every second, one after another, it would take 317 years to reach a trillion. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to hear from Jeff Madrick. That was some of Paper Planes by M.I.A., which is on the Slumdog Millionaire soundtrack. That movie is everywhere lately, even on Behind the News. All Brooklyn-associated music today, by the way. My first guest is Jeff Madrick. Madrick is editor of Challenge Magazine, director of policy research at the Schwartz Center at the New School, a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, and author most recently of The Case for Big Government. The agency problem we talk about in the interview is short for the principal-agent problem. In this context, it refers to the fact that managers run corporations on behalf of shareholders, though the interests of managers and shareholders don't always coincide. The managers are the agents, and the shareholders are the principals. From the 1930s through the late 1970s, managers ran corporations with very little interference from shareholders, even though the shareholders own corporations. But starting in the late 1970s, shareholders became far more demanding, forcing managers to cut costs to drive up profits. To align the interests of managers and shareholders, CEOs and other top executives were increasingly paid in stock and options rather than in direct salaries. The problem with this model is that the stock market is actually a rather poor evaluator of corporate prospects, although theory, economic theory, orthodox economic theory, says just the opposite. As it turned out, managers would do everything they could, including cooking the books, to get the share price up. So while this strategy made CEOs very rich, it's not done much for the broad economy, and it made downsizing and speed-up regular features of daily economic life. But we'll hear more from Jeff Madrick on that topic as the interview progresses. Jeff Madrick. Welcome, Jeff Madrick. First of all, what is your diagnosis? Let's start with the little questions. What is your diagnosis? How did we get into this this terrible pickle we're in?
That's not a little question. The proximate cause, of course, was the housing, the collapse of the housing market. But that, as I say and should stress, was the proximate cause. The main cause was the excessive abuse of the securitization, first of mortgages and then of other loans, that led to enormous amounts of lending that were far riskier than people realized, that were not insured, and then against which major investment banks, structured investment vehicles, commercial banks, bankers around the world leveraged enormously to buy. So they bought far riskier assets than they understood, and they borrowed enormously to buy those assets. And that was a function of abusing the securitization process, which allowed mortgage brokers and commercial bankers and so forth to make mortgages, sell them off immediately, care little about the risky quality of those mortgages, and most important, immediately take 1% or so of that mortgage to the bottom line, get their money back when they sell them off, and make the next mortgage. It was a system clearly doomed to fail.
But this is the culmination of a 30-year experiment in financial deregulation, isn't it?
Yeah, the deregulation. I am writing a history of the economy since the late 1960s to be published. It will probably be called The Age of Greed, to be published in late 2010. And it begins with Walter Wriston at Citi, the forerunner of Citigroup, which was then called First National Citibank. And back then, Wriston led the charge to deregulate financial markets, deregulate the commercial banks and eventually Wall Street in general. It's been going on for a very long time, and we have, as you well know, Doug, we have had several major speculative bubbles, intensely dangerous periods, and we were bailed out time and again by the Federal Reserve. Remarkable that Alan Greenspan claimed his model worked, his model, quote-unquote, what a name to call it, but he always was grandiose about his own thinking process. His model worked for 40 years. It didn't work. We had speculative bubbles and busts, and then the Fed came in to save the day, in part because of deregulation. In fact, probably in large part because of deregulation and a fancy on Wall Street and among financiers that they really knew where the money was, and they created an enormous value added for an economy. And Washington, not only the Republicans, but the Democrats, not only the presidents, but the Congress, by and large, believe them. And not only them, but the media and the big business press.
And the economics profession went along for the ride, too.
They sure did. You know, that really bugs me, Doug. Somebody wrote a letter to somebody reviewed my book in one of the major publications, and an economist wrote an angry letter about, quote-unquote, real economists. And, you know, I am tired of hearing this from the mainstream economists. Say something against free trade and you get 10,000 letters to the editor. It is not as if they don't act en masse when they, you know, together and influentially when they feel strongly about something like free trade. But where were they about deregulation? They believe allegedly in efficient markets theory. Where were they to tell us it's impossible that hedge funds could be making profits year in and year out at this rate? Where were they again about the investment banks themselves? How did investment banks make huge profits year in and year out? There's again, as you know, of course, Doug, there's a major issue called the agency problem that mainstream economists study all the time. Where were they about the agency problem when they saw these executives, traders and so forth at these investment banks and commercial banks taking in enormous bonuses based on mark-to-market profits? Where were they to criticize this as an agency problem? They were telling us, remember when they were telling us that the $145 oil price had little to do with speculation? It merely reflected supply and demand. They are a big part of the problem.
And now that agency problem you're talking about also, it was supposed to solve the problem of how to run corporations. Shareholders are supposed to get a larger role. The end of managerial domination that came in the late 70s, early 80s, and the emergence of shareholder value as the prime guiding star for corporate policy. So, you know, this was, the economists recommended this policy.
Absolutely. They recommended the policy, especially when it came to compensating executives with share prices. But and you know, and that was part of their efficient markets notion. The stock price reasonably and rationally reflected the true future prospects of the company. So why not reward executives with short-term stock options that sometimes were back priced, as we know. But the agency problem, and you know, at the bonus level for these banks was, you know, it was part and parcel of that problem. But clearly, it got way out of hand. They were managing risk for themselves personally, and not for the company.
But now, what about what Wall Street sometimes hilariously calls the real sector? What were the contributions of that to this problem? It's not just a financial issue. For example, the evisceration of American manufacturing. Does it have a role?
Yeah. Well, wasn't the government had a big role in that. The dollar started to rise rapidly, really, in the early 1980s under Reagan and the very high real interest rates under Chairman Volcker. Paused for a while with the Plaza Accord, then started its major rise in value. And, of course, the dollar relationship with the Chinese currencies was at best problematical and incorrectly fixed. The Chinese currency should not have been priced that way. And that seriously undermined manufacturing in the nation. That was number one. And the Clinton administration, under the high dollar, was one of the major achievements in Bob Rubin's mind under Bill Clinton. They loved the high dollar. It attracted a heck of a lot of money from overseas. It allowed us to buy things that we didn't have enough income for, so we could borrow. It was great for Wall Street, and all that money shuffling around the world, for which they always took a piece. And not only did they take a piece, it drove up debt and security values and derivative values, from which they profited enormously. But that was one problem which didn't get talked about very much. I mean, our manufacturing industries were at a severe price disadvantage because of the run-up of the dollar for the most part. But second, the assumption, and I think you agree with this, but the assumption that the private sector would invest in all areas that were necessary for American prosperity, I think, is naive. Private investment has failed in many areas. We just haven't built up the things we need. There are great holes that have to be filled by public investment, and we better turn our attention to it. Just sending people to college is not going to do the job. We need to create middle-class jobs for people who don't necessarily go to college or only go a year or two. It's getting pretty serious. You know, high school kids, manufacturing jobs are pretty good for high school graduates, but high school kids don't. There's no great benefit anymore in graduating from high school because high school diploma wages are so low. The kids rather go out and work a year or two and get started in something. We're in quite a mess.
And then what, if any, contribution from income polarization, which has been massive over the last 30, 35 years?
Well, you know, my concern is I don't like to call it income inequality because I think that really misses what went on. It's a very broad income stagnation. The inequality, the measurement of the issue was very much, and I'm kind of an outlier on this, but I think people are coming to agree with this. The inequality issue per se was very much biased by the enormous amount of money made through financialization by CEOs and these people on Wall Street at the very, very top. You take out the top 1%, inequality didn't look so bad in America. But inequality can mean several things. One can mean the top rises faster than the middle and the bottom, but the middle and the bottom are rising. It didn't mean that in America. It meant the very top made a lot of money, I believe artificially for the most part, through financialization. And the middle and the lower middle and the bottom saw wages stagnate, especially for men. And that, to me, is the major problem in America. And it's wound up with the high dollar, the loss of manufacturing, the failure to recognize that governmental policies are needed to keep wages up to allow appropriate workers to organize into labor unions, and to create an environment where we do not have a financial community that has created enormous incentives for CEOs to keep wages down through leveraged buyouts, takeovers, private equity, and so forth. It's just a darn outrage. People forget that Chairman Volcker, I like to call him that, because now, as you know, Doug, he's the liberal in the Obama economics team. And I respect him in many ways. I thought he went overboard in the early 80s, but I do respect him as a very straight, as pretty straight shooter. He wanted to regulate loans. Do you remember this? Loans for leveraged buyouts and takeovers in the mid-1980s. He wanted to make them subject to margin requirements, bank loans. And the new guys on the new Reagan appointees to the Fed, Preston Martin and so forth, really watered down that approach. People kind of forget that. It was another opportunity missed to make to balance this economy.
And he was squeezed out, essentially, and replaced with the mighty Allen.
Yeah, well, he wasn't so keen on those whopping deficits that people kept saying didn't matter at all when they're under Republicans. They only matter when they're under Democrats.
Except the last Democrat shrank the deficit. So.
Yeah, he did. I think that was not the cause of the boom. I think the boom was the cause of that. But, my point of view is he should have used the surplus to invest significantly in America, and he didn't. So I'm a little angry about that, and very willfully. You remember, I think it was 1998, he said, we're only going to use the surplus, put it in a lockbox for Social Security, which was never going to work, and only meant that we wouldn't use it for other purposes.
I'm speaking with Jeff Madrick, who is the editor of Challenge Magazine, the director of the Schwartz Center at the New School, and author of The Case for Big Government. All right, now having laid all this out, we now have seen the first draft of Obama's first budget. Some of the pundits are calling it the repudiation of Reaganism, a massive change in direction for the American economy. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think it is a massive change. I think passing the stimulus, many people, and I'm in that camp, think it should have been bigger and there should have been no tax cuts. But I am not in the camp of being very critical of Obama. Quite the opposite. I think it was an extraordinary achievement so quickly. I do think the priorities in the new budget are correct. I do think for the most part they are a beginning, but it's quite a beginning. We've got a long way to go for health care reform, but it's a serious step at taking a first step. A lot more money for education and the recognition that our education system is failing us as opposed to constantly being told it's working for us. You know, it's like health care. Education is a little like health care. America no longer has the most kids 18 to 25 going to college, the highest proportion of kids. Korea is number one. Several European countries are ahead of us. Lots have caught up with us, and they also have better often have better K through 12 for many of those students. Some of our K through 12 is fine, but lots of it isn't. And so I'm pretty happy. I do think we're beginning to overcome that Reagan issue. You know, that Reagan ideology. The book I wrote, The Case for Big Government, is about being a prisoner to that ideology. And it was written before the credit crisis. It's about government. You know, people all over the place love to say government never created a job. Only business creates jobs. Even Geithner basically said that at his first speech the other day, which went over like a lead balloon. But, you know, my attitude is business. Government creates jobs. Government at the least creates workers through education and health care. It creates commerce through transportation infrastructure. It creates, it enables people to trust contracts through its legal system, and on and on. And it creates an open market through regulations and transparency, and enables us to have adequate demand for this economy by supporting wages when workers often don't have the bargaining power to get the wages they need. So I think we're moving in the right direction. I think we have to shed ourselves of the ideology. Am I convinced we will? I am not yet convinced. I will be convinced when we're willing to raise taxes, and that my book calls for raising taxes by 3 or 4% of GDP to pay for the public investment social programs we need and make an aggressive effort at public more public spending.
What about the deficit? It's enormous, 12, 13% of GDP. Is it something to worry about? How can we deal with it over the longer term?
Well, you know, I think it's something to worry about, but we have far bigger worries, and I do think it's manageable. I think if I want to leave your listeners with only one message, is that this is not just a recession, but a little worse, to borrow the way a friend of mine, Mark Levinson, put it recently. It is very much worse. It is failing on several of our six-cylinder engines are failing simultaneously, the housing market, the credit system, and now outright recession and demand, consumer demand, simply falling off the cliff. That's far more serious than any recession, including the 82 recession we've had. We've got to take measures to stem that, because if the recession itself gets worse, the housing will get worse, credit crisis will get worse, and we'll sink into an abysmal hole that will take us a very, very long time to get out of. This sort of insensitivity to that really disturbs me. So I think if we don't take the deficits now, let's call them constructive big deficits now, we will get destructive bigger deficits down the road and serious fallen standard of living and serious suffering from poverty, many people falling into poverty, to careers and lives ruined, hopes dashed, families undermined, small business hopes evaporate. You know, recessions are severe things, and people look back and think depressions are severe things, surely, and severe recessions. People look back and say, well, we got out of that. You know, don't worry about it. Economies grow. Having no historical imagination about the pain, say, of the Great Depression and the lives ruined and the fear and probably lives ended early, not through suicide but through anxiety and, you know, and disease and not eating well and so forth. We really need it. We really need a good shake-up of historical empathy. We just don't have it, and it's part of this sort of national, I wouldn't call it a malaise, but some kind of disease that made us insensitive to to economic reality.
Well, along the lines of national diseases, there's just an incredible epidemic of corruption at every level, which is really quite stunning.
Yeah, you know, it's that's when you know markets work, when there's a big payoff, you know, a big payoff for corruption, you get a big supply of corruption. There's been a big payoff in these markets for corruption. You could really make a lot of money, and the supply always seems to meet the demand. But on the other hand, I never could have imagined something like Madoff happening. That, to me, you know, now we're seeing lots of, we call mini, $8 billion is a mini Madoff, you know, in this case of this fellow Stanford. But I'm still stunned by the Madoff thing. It just blows my mind, and obviously it's some symptom of modern society, but it seems to be more in the realm of James Bond 007 villainy, which I always thought was a fantasy, but this guy he's a living embodiment of the fantasy of Dr. No and Smersh and Spectre. Yeah, this guy is something.
What's your diagnosis of how the financial bailout is going? Are they doing it right or being too indulgent of the likes of Citigroup?
They may be being too indulgent. My impression is they're just not doing enough, frankly. While I like the bailout, I think it's been remarkable. I think the housing plan makes sense. I don't think there's enough there. And I think they're afraid, really, to do what's necessary. It could be national. There are a lot of ways to go on this. They're really not going any which way. They're allowing themselves to get behind the curve. Even if we did a bad bank or, you know, an insurance plan, the way the UK is just doing with the Royal Bank of Scotland, I guess, you could price that. So it's very harsh on the banks. They wouldn't have to be giveaways. And I find this a little bit indulgent of Citigroup. Yeah, I think they're scared to get out in front of this crisis. And that is maybe my biggest concern with the current Obama plan. I believe in Obama much more than I believe in the Obama team, frankly. So I think we have to get out there with some serious money, but with stringent demands when we give out that money. And some way, and you know, you can describe it any way you like, bad banks or nationalization or some euphemism for nationalization, but some way that when and if these markets turn around, the U.S. will get a lot of that money back.
And finally, what's your judgment if, you know, if the budget is passed in something like its proposed form and the bailout carries on in something like the way it's been? What's your judgment of how long this slide continues?
Well, I think the slide has to continue through this year. I think it will depend on whether they take a very firm, as I've been saying, develop a firm bailout plan and a more generous plan to stop the housing defaults. You have to fight this on all fronts. This is not something that can be fought on only one front. If we do that, I think we'll see bottom. We could see bottom within a year or even slightly less. Then the question is, do we bounce right back like we did in 1983? And that's more problematic, I think. We may have a long U-shaped recovery after that, or even an L for a while. And you know, interest rates may go up again. There are lots of unknowns that I'm just not good enough to predict about what happens to the dollar after its recent rise. There is a bubble in Treasury bills, really, as far as I can tell. But, you know, what do you do? Where do you go after that? So there'll be some unknowns down there, but I think we've got to stop the decline and start at least looking up a little bit.
That was Jeff Madrick. He is the editor of Challenge Magazine, director of policy research at the Schwartz Center at the New School in New York, a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, and author most recently of The Case for Big Government, published by Princeton University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with David Himmelstein.
And when you're swept to sea, there's people like me, and then there's people like you. We don't see evil, they don't know what they do. Tiny and few. And when you're swept to sea, there's people like me, and then there's people like you. We don't see evil, they don't know what they do.
Some of One Life to Leave, a Requiem by OutHud, a band first formed in Berkeley, but then moved to Brooklyn, where they broke up a couple of years ago. My next guest is David Himmelstein. David is a primary care physician at Cambridge Hospital in Massachusetts and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard. He's one of the founders of Physicians for a National Health Program and one of our leading experts on healthcare finance. David Himmelstein. All right, David, so it's a little early, of course, but what do you see coming out of the Obama administration for a healthcare plan? Some people are getting rather excited.
Unfortunately, what we're hearing is more of the same old stuff. It's leaving the private insurance industry in the middle of the healthcare system and then adding government money to it and maybe requiring people to actually purchase coverage, most of it again, from private insurance companies. And really leaving the structure that's caused the problem pretty much undisturbed.
PNHP sent out an alert the other day saying that Max Baucus has ruled out any consideration of single payer and that Teddy Kennedy is going to promote the Massachusetts plan because he's been meeting with insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and such. Tell us more about Teddy Kennedy. We thought he was kind of a good guy.
Well, I think Ted Kennedy has been a good guy and really has fought for national health insurance for many years. I think he's a sick man who's pretty desperate at this point, and he's desperate to get any deal he can. And unfortunately, that deal that he thinks he can get at this point really isn't going to help patients, and that's the problem with it.
And what about Baucus? Why rule out single payer?
Well, Baucus keeps hearing from people, we want single payer, and he keeps saying no, no, no. And I think he's trying to squelch the increasing voluble demand that actually has to be on the table. And the way he's trying to do that is to say, we're not even going to talk about it. It's a non-starter, and trying to get people to then focus on the things that he'd like to have them talk about rather than actually what the nation wants and what the nation needs.
This is somewhat reminiscent of that story you told of when you were talking to Hillary Clinton. It's just, we know this is reasonable, but we're just not going to do it. It's what it seems to come down to.
I think you're right that we've heard this before, and frankly, we've heard it before in many states that have done health reform. So it's what we heard in Massachusetts back 3 years ago when we were discussing health reform here, and in many states before that. And the problem is that they come up with political deals that they can get through the legislature and get the governor or president to sign, but they don't actually fix the healthcare system. So, yeah, we got a law in Massachusetts, but it's a law that's not working. It's actually leaving hundreds of thousands of people uninsured and millions more with inadequate coverage. And meanwhile, health costs are continuing to spiral out of control. And as a result, the safety net institutions that serve the poor, serve the mentally ill, serve people who aren't strong in our society, those are getting slashed as the costs rise and the state is pulling money out of the vital services in order to desperately try and keep the health reform afloat.
And since this looks to be something of a model for a national plan, give us more detail on what's happened in Massachusetts. It's now, what, we're 3 years into it, you say?
Well, we're really about a year and a half, 2 years into it in a major way. And they've signed up a fair number of people for the new insurance, but it's such lousy coverage that actually even people who have the coverage often can't afford what they need. So we're seeing AIDS patients who are stopping their medicines because they used to be able to get free medicines under the state's free care plan, and now they have copayments every time they need a prescription filled. We're seeing patients with curable cancers who can't afford their chemotherapy because the copayments and deductibles actually don't let them afford medications. And we're still seeing lots of uninsured people, but the funding to take care of those uninsured people has dried up, and in particular, the funding for mental health care has been slashed in the state because the budget to fund this health reform has been much higher than anticipated, and the place the state has gone to get the money is to take the money that was there to support care of the chronically mentally ill and drain it for this health reform. Meanwhile, the health insurance companies are making out like bandits, and the wealthy hospitals have actually been making huge profits. So I would say it's been good for the hospitals, good for the insurance companies, not very good for patients. And a survey by the Harvard School of Public Health and Kaiser Foundation, Blue Cross Foundation, actually found that of people who said they were directly affected by the reform, more said they were worse off than better off because of it.
The plan does offer basic health insurance for people who don't have it otherwise. What's that look like? How much does it cost?
Well, for someone my age, it costs $4,800 a year, and that coverage has a $2,000 deductible, so you don't get a penny paid for until you've got $2,000 out of your own pocket. And after that, you're paying 20% of your own bills. So basically what they're saying is pay almost $7,000 before you have any coverage at all, and after that, 20% of everything for quite a ways, and that they call coverage.
And 20% is a lot. I mean, these costs can rack up very, very quickly, right?
Yeah, now there's a maximum out-of-pocket of $5,000, but basically for people making $30,000 a year, and that's who's supposed to be buying this stuff, someone making $30,000 a year could easily have $10,000, $11,000, $12,000 worth of medical bills that their insurance doesn't cover. And that's not even close to being affordable. And the result is that people aren't getting the care they need. And meanwhile, the number of uninsured in the state is already going back up. We've had 85,000 people lose their jobs in just the last year. And the number of people covered under the plan has not increased at all.
And Massachusetts is one of the better economies in the country. People are mandated to buy this coverage. What are the penalties like, and what kind of compliance is there?
Well, if you don't buy the coverage, then you face a $1,000 fine if the state deems the coverage affordable for you. So just to put that in context, a terrorist threat is a smaller fine than that, or drunk driving is a $500 fine. So in Massachusetts now, not buying insurance that you can't afford is worse offense than making a terrorist threat or driving drunk. The enforcement is through the tax system. When you file your income tax returns, you have to file proof of coverage or an appeal that there is not affordable coverage available to you. The Department of Revenue tells us that 5% of taxpayers are failing to show that they have coverage. Some of those are getting out because coverage is not affordable according to the state schedule, and some are paying the fine.
But a mandate of this sort is likely to be part of any kind of plan that the Democrats come up with, right?
That's what we're hearing from Washington, and it's really a kind of a pitiful commentary on where the Democratic Party has gone. This was Richard Nixon's plan back in 1971 that he put out as a way to try and block Ted Kennedy's national health insurance proposal back then. And
now we have Ted Kennedy taking the Nixon position.
What more can I say than that? But I think the other thing that's worth pointing out about it is a mandate is a poll tax. It's poll tax. It's a flat set amount that everybody has to pay regardless of their income. So it's saying that someone who's making $1 million a year pays the same amount as someone making $30,000 a year. It's an extraordinarily regressive tax, and it's government using its coercive power to make you buy a defective private product from a private company. So it's saying you have to buy private insurance, and it's lousy private insurance, and if you don't, we'll use government power to make you do it, and meanwhile make profits for the insurance companies from selling it to you.
People pay a lot of attention to the uninsured, but another problem in our health insurance system is that people with insurance find that there has a lot of holes in it where they try to use it, or they even lose it. So has the Massachusetts scheme done anything for that?
No, in fact, if anything, it's worse. We've got a lot more people underinsured, so some of the newly covered have something that's called insurance, but actually they still can't afford care because the insurance is so lousy that it really doesn't help them. And costs are continuing to go up. We were promised cost containment, just as Obama is promising cost containment under his plan nationally, but there's been no cost containment. Costs are still going up far faster than inflation, and more people are being priced out of the market. Copayments and deductibles are still rising as employers are cutting back on what they're paying for. So the solution that's been proposed for the nation and that we really have here in Massachusetts just is a non-solution.
Now, as we're recording this on Thursday, drug stocks are taking a hit on Wall Street because fears of price controls. Democratic victories have been thought to be bad for the insurance industry and for the hospital sector. Are investors misreading these signals?
Well, I think that the drug stocks are taking a hit partly because they're worried about the Democrats, but frankly more because they're not inventing anything worthwhile that's new. So the drug stocks have been driven down because their research pipeline is empty, and I think that's an indictment of the commercial research model that's been pursued in this country for drugs over the last two decades or so. I think there is some misreading of the Democrats, but there's still a significant element of the Democratic Party that really does want to do the right thing in healthcare. They're being, at this point, put down by the Obama people and people like Max Baucus. But hey, there are 94 members of Congress who signed on to a single-payer bill last session, virtually all of them, I think all of them Democrats, and we expect at least that many this year. So there's a significant faction in the Democratic Party that does want to push further, and we'll likely at least do some things around the edges, for instance, with the Medicare drug plans and some of the Medicare HMO plans. They're likely to not pump quite as much money in the direction of the HMOs and drug companies as the Republicans did.
I'm speaking with David Himmelstein, who is one of the founders of Physicians for a National Health Program, teacher at Harvard Medical School and primary care physician at the Cambridge Hospital in Massachusetts. I want to return to this in a moment, but a couple more things about Obama and the Democrats, or the mainstream Democrats. There's a lot of talk about cost controls. How do they envision that? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, there are three things they say are going to control costs. One is computerization. There's not an iota of evidence that computerization of medical records saves money. It pays a lot to GE and IBM and Microsoft, and they've been the lobbyists for it, and maybe it'll improve quality, though that's not really clear yet. But the likelihood it'll hold down costs is nil. Congressional Budget Office has said that there's no evidence for that.
It's something those the neoliberal third way types love, though. It's like a micro initiative that seems kind of high tech.
Yeah, I mean, you know, wave a machine at it and it'll fix it. But where it's been tried thus far, it hasn't worked, and we have no reason to believe it'll work in the future. The second thing they're saying is that disease management is going to save money. So we're going to take these patients who have very expensive problems like diabetes and heart failure, and we're going to do better management of them and save money that way. And the problem with that is that's been tried and failed as well. The Medicare program actually just had a demonstration project of that approach. And what they've found is that it didn't save money or improve quality. So we hear that's one of the main strategies for how Obama thinks that money's going to be saved, but there's nothing there. And the third is prevention. Now, I'm all in favor of prevention. I'm a primary care doctor, and I spend a lot of my day doing that. But again, there's no evidence that you save money. You keep people alive longer, and that's what we work for. But people, when they're alive, actually cost money, and helping people live into old age means that they end up getting expensively ill and they need many more years of medical care. And the data that's been looked at in this says prevention actually increases costs. It doesn't decrease costs. We should do it. That's the whole point of medical care. But the fantasy that that's how we're going to save money is just that, a fantasy.
It'll cost the Social Security system more if people live longer.
Exactly. I mean, smoking saves money. It kills you young.
The Obama administration is talking about a $670-something billion fund over the next 10 years to cover the uninsured. What do you make of that?
I mean, it's nice that they want to cover the uninsured and that they want to devote money to it. We actually are spending plenty in the healthcare system at present to cover everybody in this country with terrific medical care if we did it right. So unfortunately, the fund is actually a way to try and keep the healthcare system dominated by the insurance companies and still allow some coverage of the uninsured. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't address either the cost problem that all of us are facing or the problem that tens of millions of insured people are facing that we can't afford coverage. So I think it's a fine sentiment, it's a nice gesture, but it's no way to fix the healthcare system.
So let's turn to the what is to be done question. And I'm sure the audience is familiar with a lot of this, but let's just review it because it deserves to be reviewed. How can you cover everyone and save money at the same time?
Well, we're spending about $400 billion each year on useless bureaucracy in healthcare. So the insurance companies take their cut, and then they inflict a tremendous amount of paperwork on doctors and hospitals and nursing homes and everybody else in the system. Just to make that concrete, you know, Toronto General Hospital, when I visited there years ago, had three people in its billing office, big hospital, full range of services, but they get paid like a fire department does in this country. They get paid one check a week for their entire operation. And the billing office's job really is to send bills to Americans who wander across the border. And a comparable size hospital in the U.S. would have 350, 400 people doing nothing but billing work, not because they're inefficient, but because that's what you have to do with our system, which has hundreds of different insurance plans, each trying not to pay the bills and fighting with hospitals and doctors over their bills. So there's $400 billion in bureaucratic waste and unnecessary profits. I mean, why is it we should pay an insurance company CEO for doing nothing that's useful? And that $400 billion is more than enough to cover all of the uninsured and to upgrade coverage for all the rest of us without any increase in healthcare costs. So that's how it ought to be done. I mean, there are other things that need to be done, too. We ought to rationalize some of our use of technology. So at this point, we actually have too much of high-tech stuff, and that's no good for patients. It means that in many cities around the country, for instance, we've got more transplant centers than we should have, and means that each one is doing fewer transplants than you have to do to be good at it. It means that we have so many CT scanners that sit idle a lot of the time that the radiologists are tempted to recommend CT scans willy-nilly, and that's a huge dose of radiation often for things that don't help patients. So when you hear get a cardiac scan as a routine, that's the equivalent of 500 chest x-rays or so in radiation. We have no idea whether that helps people or not. We know that it increases their chances of getting cancer. So rationalizing technology in many cases would both save us money and improve quality of care, and that ought to be part of the system. We ought to encourage more primary care and less specialty care. We've got too many cardiologists doing too many stents. We know that about 40% of them do patients no good. And yet patients can't get an appointment with a primary care doctor, can't get a family doctor to do their basic preventive care. So we need to reorient the healthcare system away from the sale of expensive commodities and high-tech gadgets and towards taking care of people. We need much more investment in long-term care, particularly home care and community services for families that are having trouble taking care of disabled people in their families.
But just to underscore the point, that sort of thing is not sufficiently profitable to the right kinds of people, right?
Right. I mean, one of the things in Massachusetts at this point we've seen is long-term care, psychiatric care, primary care, even for insured people, those are money losers. And the wealthy hospitals aren't investing in those. So you've got Massachusetts General Hospital making $350 million profit in 1 year. And people waiting in their ER for 2-3 days to get into an inpatient psychiatric bed when they're suicidal because there are no beds. And they're building a huge new hospital building, but there are no psych beds in there because that's not where the money is. So all over this country, the crying needs of communities are going unmet, even for the insured. And meanwhile, we're really shaping the healthcare system based on what's profitable.
And a related point, the HMO and the insurance system is set up to make money by denying people care, right?
Right. Well, every time we pay a premium, anything that isn't paid out as a healthcare benefit stays with the company. So they refer to it as the loss ratio, how much of health of their premium dollars lost to medical care. But to us, that's actually the care that we want them to pay for. So that's the constant fight here. And the average insurance company in the U.S. is paying out only about 86 cents of every dollar that they receive, and the rest stays with them as overhead and profit and outrageous salaries for their CEOs. Medicare runs for 3% overhead. Canadian National Health Insurance Program, which has a far more streamlined way of paying, which is what we ought to adopt, has overhead of less than 1%.
And finally, there is, you mentioned earlier, a bill in Congress with almost 100 co-sponsors to universalize Medicare. Tell us about that and its prospects.
Well, H.R. 676 is the National Health Insurance Bill, also called the Medicare for All Bill, and basically it would say everybody gets comprehensive coverage for all medically necessary services paid for out of taxes and with simplified billing and administrative apparatus to save the money we need to save, and extension of services like long-term care and community services and psychiatric care. So it's a bill which would clearly work. We know it would work because it's been basically demonstrated in several other countries already. But it's politically difficult because we're talking about wiping out the private insurance industry and saying to the drug companies, we're not going to import Canadian drugs, but we'll import Canadian prices. And that's what they fear much more.
You said it's got almost 100 co-sponsors. What do its prospects look like now that we're probably entering a political season of serious health care reform?
Well, it's hard to gauge the prospects because we're in such an unstable economic and political climate. At the moment, if you had a vote, we definitely wouldn't win. But the country is crumbling at this point, and saying that people have to buy insurance from a private insurance company, I think, is going to become increasingly a non-starter in the months ahead. So as this debate goes on, I suspect the tide will turn our way. Whether it'll turn enough our way and fast enough our way, we'll have to see. What we know is that we need people to mobilize and tell their congresspeople, tell their senators, and tell the White House that single payer has to be on the table as part of this debate, and it's actually the only thing that can work. You know, I guess as a doctor, I liken it to we've got a cancer in our healthcare system. It's the private insurance industry. It's a very difficult cancer to eradicate, but we know the cure for it. It's single-payer national health insurance. And the Obama folks wish that herbs and easy treatments could fix it, but they can't. So we have to go for the tough stuff, which we absolutely know can cure this sick healthcare system.
That was David Himmelstein. Himmelstein is a primary care physician at Cambridge Hospital in Massachusetts, associate professor of medicine at Harvard, and one of the leading lights of Physicians for a National Health Program. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with some more Brooklyn music. This from the electropop duo Telepathy, spelled with an E at the end, not a Y, and some of their song, Lights Go Down, which is just out electronically and will be out on CD in a few weeks. Till next week, bye.